Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine Podcast Radio. You're about to listen to an episode of Tech Done Different Podcast with Ted Harrington. Do you follow the pack or challenge the status quo? Join Ted as he explores how to succeed by going against conventional wisdom. You'll hear leaders in technology and security tell stories about how they achieve their success by doing things differently. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Tech Done Different. I'm your host, Ted Harrington. And with me here today is our special guest, Brian Reckworth, the founder of Latitude. Brian, welcome to the show.
Hey, it's a pleasure, Ted. Thanks for having me on.
So, Brian, let's dive right in. And let me ask you the immediate burning question that I have about you. When you look at your profile, and I'd also like you to sort of talk about your background as you answer this, but you have certainly achieved entrepreneurial success in Latin America, yet as anyone could hear by you, as you already spoke, you're an American, you're from California. How does a Californian wind up achieving the type of success you did in Latin America?
Yeah, actually, I got in my car. Like you said, I'm from California, and I drove from California to Costa Rica and bought a one-way ticket to Bogota, Colombia. And, you know, usually, you know, there's a woman behind these stories. My wife and I met in San Diego, actually close to by where you live. So that's where we ended up meeting. And then, you know, she likes to say that she imported me to Colombia after that. But on a 6-month journey, kind of traversing Mexico and Central America, sold my car in Costa Rica, and I ended up moving to Colombia with plans to make it all the way down to Patagonia. But life happened, and I ended up, you know, spending a few months, turned into a, you know, 6 years of living in Colombia, and then made it closer to Patagonia, moving to Brazil after that. My business took me down to Sao Paulo. That's a little bit more about my story and how I landed in Latin America and ultimately lived there for about almost 15 years.
So one of the things that I think is really great to have you on the show is that you've in so many ways embodied the sort of milestones of success that many of our listeners might be aspiring to as well. You started a company, you raised capital, you sold the company, started another company, you've invested in yet other companies with the money that you've made along the way. Can you just tell us the story behind your sort of entrepreneurial journey, and then we'll dive into some of the lessons we can extract from it?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely remember the word, learning about the word entrepreneur, right, as a kid. And I can distinctly remember as a kid, like telling my friends, I want to be an entrepreneur. And, you know, like high school kids kind of like, you know, gently teasing you. Yeah, sure. You want to be an entrepreneur. That's a real fancy word, you know, kind of. But it was something that was just intrinsically I was inspired to build something. And it's something that's been a calling for a while. The way it started, I ended up living in Latin America. You know, I actually applied for some jobs, and, you know, because I needed to pay the bills, right? I wanted to visit this woman. We ended up getting married, and I'm like, I got to sustain myself. And so I quickly realized that no one really hired me for anything. So I had this seed planted that I wanted to build something. So I did everything possible in the beginning just to kind of pay the bills. I was an English teacher. I bought a book about how to teach business English, and I would literally walk down the street in mega city of Bogota, Colombia with 7 million. And I would knock on these doors and basically sell these English classes. And I did that for the first year and a half just to, you know, sustain myself and pay the bills. So, but the ambition always got a little bit bigger through the different entrepreneurial, you know, endeavors that I did. After that, you know, I kind of figured out how I could leverage the fact that I was an American. So I did translation services, and then we ended up building websites because, you know, companies started needing websites. And so there was like all these little stepping stones that kind of leveled me up. And I guess that, as I had some degree of success in the early days of being able to make things work, just the ideas kept getting bigger, I guess, is the kind of short story. And eventually, you know, the last company that I built for the listeners, just to kind of understand, it was a real estate marketplace, which is similar to like Zillow in the US, but for Brazil. And, you know, we scaled that company to about 1,000 employees. We ended up selling the company for $550 million in last year, in November of 2020. And since then, I've just been investing in a bunch of other companies and also kind of considering what I want to build next. So that's a quick kind of tie-in in terms of the last 15 years of my journey in Latin America.
That's really cool. One thing that stood out to me as you were talking about your journey, I share the same passion from being a child. It's like, I'm going to be an entrepreneur, and kind of not even really knowing what that means. Almost feeling like, does that mean I just don't want a job? Right?
Yeah.
So I have this question for you as someone who shares maybe a similar worldview. I'm curious to the answer to this. Do you think that entrepreneurship is innate? Either you're born with it or you're not, or is it something that people can acquire?
No, I think absolutely. Like, I mean, I think there's certain people that have the burning desire early, but I think that, like, you know, I think that there's incredible stories of people, you know, doing things later. There's a, you know, I think the founder of Kentucky Fried Chicken was like 65 or something. Right. So like, you know, it's not like you hop out the womb and all of a sudden you're ready to kind of like, you know, get your hustle on as a founder. I think that you know, the best ideas and the best businesses ultimately are born out of a deep passion to solve a problem. Right. And so, you know, if you can find yourself assembling around a problem to solve, you know, that will then lead you to potentially building a company. And so if you're a curious person, you might be curious in general of different topics, but if there's something that really sparks your curiosity and you feel possessed to solve a specific problem, that's a good starting point for an entrepreneurship journey, because you'll just be motivated to like figure out how to make it work.
Yeah, that's a consistent theme that we seem to be hearing here on Tech Done Different, that it really boils down to solving problems. And I think that's an inverted way of thinking about it, that people who are not entrepreneurs think about entrepreneurship. People who are not entrepreneurs often think that it's, well, what's the way I can get richest, the most rich, the fastest? And riches do come to entrepreneurs eventually, but you're only successful if you're trying to solve the problem. So what's your advice for how to actually identify problems worth solving? I mean, like, traffic sucks. Okay. How do you now build a business around a problem? You notice the traffic. I'm not saying let's develop that business plan right now, but how do you identify problems?
Yeah, well, I mean, I actually met the founder of Waze when I was at Stanford doing that's exactly what happened. Right. So that's a good example. You know, he was in Israel. He ended up, you know, building Waze and, you know, built it into a global company, which Google acquired for $1 billion. So, you know, the question for me, I look at it with a very specific lens, because I tend to be involved in companies that are venture backed businesses, right? That my company, I ended up raising, you know, significant capital from investors. We raised about $75 million from investors. And those are the businesses that I particularly, you know, am involved with. Entrepreneurship is a very broad topic, right? You know, if you have a bakery in your local town, you're an entrepreneur. Like, you're hustling, you're making the best muffins possible on your, and that's definitely like something that is super important. And that's what drives, you know, the US economy is small business. The types of businesses that I particularly am involved with or start or invest in are typically problems that are very large problems that are almost like, take any sector of the economy. And the reason why I've been gravitated towards Latin America is because there's no shortage of problems. Things just don't work as well as they do in the US, right? If you're looking to buy a house, you know, the efficiency of the real estate market, you know, there's zero data. Like, you don't know what the value of any transactions that happened in your neighborhood are. So imagine the complexity of trying to buy a house with having zero visibility into how that works. Or, you know, you're trying to, you know, the education system, like, it's broken in a lot of areas. And I think that, you know, Latin America is not special in that way. There's problems to solve everywhere in the world, the US included, lots of things to be done. And so when I kind of look at it, I look at it from the standpoint, and I'll put my investor hat on, but I could use the same hat to think about as an entrepreneur. I personally have like maybe a fishing analogy that I would use. It's kind of like, okay, is this a big lake? Is there a lot of fish in this lake? Is it a big market? And then I would, you know, then ask myself like, okay, who's fishing? Is there a lot of people fishing here? Okay. That's the competition. That's the opportunity. You know, and you know, who's fishing is, you know, is the team good, right? And is the team designed to be able to solve this specific problem? Is there some unique insight that I have as an entrepreneur that allows me and gives me a competitive advantage over those that are also fishing in that area? So I think that those are kind of the things that that's a very simple framework that I think about. But it, you know, the question that you ask is a good one, is like, how do you ideate, right? What's a framework for ideation? My framework is basically choose massive markets, where there's high inefficiencies and old incumbents that are building businesses. That's how I particularly do it. And that's how I like to think about, you know, the business that I build or invest in. But you know, I think that, you know, if there's an intrinsic motivation to solve it also, that's where you're going to really fight through the challenges of making it work. Because, you know, as an example, there's an entrepreneur that I invested in, and she's tackling the kind of the healthcare system in Brazil. And, you know, her mother, was diagnosed with cancer, and, you know, like they just got really shuffled around in this loss in the system. And that's a pretty strong motivator, right? Like when she's like, I'm going to solve healthcare in Brazil. That's a good reason to start a business.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really interesting too, to everything that you just said is helping me organize thoughts around where opportunities are. And I have this, this real estate investor coming on in a couple of weeks, who one of his big philosophies is about, you know, identify markets that people are excited about and then go look at the market right next to it. So that's obviously like a physical real estate analogy, but it's like, instead of investing in Chicago, go invest an hour outside of Chicago because no one's looking there, but the same dynamics all exist. And what you're saying, or part of what you're saying, is that, you know, in Latin America, there's things just don't work as well here. So there's more opportunities. And so the same idea that might even still work here is going to maybe work better somewhere else. Is that a correct summary?
That's correct. I mean, I think that, you know, the second piece to that is you got to make sure that you're building something that people want, right? So you don't want to solve Silicon Valley problems in, you know, in Bogota, Colombia, right? You want to make sure that those are intrinsic problems, but markets operate relatively similar, right? If you're, you know, if you're looking at a market, like, you know, you mentioned traffic, you mentioned, you know, transportation in general, like micro mobility is a problem to be solved in any mega city, right? And so I do think that there are, you know, these are large markets. The region has 700 million people. So it's a fairly large, you know, part of the world. And there's, you know, it's when you kind of aggregate, it's a pretty big economy. And so, yeah, there's definitely a big problems to solve across the board.
Sure. So let's talk about maybe some failures a little bit. And, you know, feel free to disclose or not disclose whatever you might want to, but, you know, it's often said that there's really no such thing as failure. Either you're stumbling forward or you're succeeding. The only failure is not learning from a mistake. Is there a mistake that you can think of in your experience that was certainly memorable for you, that you learned something from and it helped you think and behave differently as a result?
Well, while we're on the topic of like ideation and what kind of business to build, first of all, I stumbled a handful of times before I figured out what works, right? People love to talk about like, you know, how successful they were in what worked. You know, it's kind of like when my dad comes home and from playing golf, he talks about, you know, hole 17 where he birdied it, but he doesn't talk about the triple bogey that he had, you know, on 16. Right. So, my journey was when I started out, I did a lot of things that didn't work. And I guess going back to the ideation thought is my first idea just was not an interesting market. You know, like our first company we started, wasn't even a company. We just built a product. We were, you know, we went to a computer supply kind of mall in this big city, and there's all these people selling computer equipment. And my idea was to just build these kind of like e-commerce websites for these, you know, these companies. I mean, way too early for an idea like that. You know, the internet wasn't deeply penetrated. Second, there's a big company called Mercado Libre, which is basically like Amazon, which was, you know, had like gazillion amounts of dollars in funding and was, you know, run by some pretty legit people. So, I ended up just kind of falling on my face because, you know, it was the wrong market, wrong potential customer. I remember our first customer we sold this website. We built the website. We collected half of the money. We showed up the next day and the guy was gone, right? He wasn't there. This particular shopping mall was kind of like a place where they sold black market, stuff. And like, I didn't even know that. And so I heard that the guy like got in trouble and he had to close his business. And so like, that's probably an example of choosing the wrong market, right? So back to your other question is like, how do you choose an opportunity? There's definitely a framework for thinking about it. Is it a big market? Is it something that, is inefficient? These are all things that you would map. But I stumbled a lot on my journey. And, I think that it wasn't, to your point, it wasn't like, it was a failure. It was just like the stepping stone on the journey, right? You're walking, you're on that hike up the mountain and, there's a switchback and you gotta adjust and you gotta stop and drink some water and then you keep on going. Right. And so it's about the journey, not the destination.
Yeah. I totally hear you on that for sure. And it sounds like you're doing exactly what was inherent in the question, right? While you did stumble, the next time you figured out, okay, well now I have to understand the market better. I have to understand not just what is a good market, but who are the people I'm doing business with and that kind of stuff. So, how does one do those kinds of things? So certainly you gave us a really good framework. I love it. Finding where there's inefficiencies, where there's longstanding outdated incumbents. What's your methodology for how you actually determine the triggers of those that say, yeah, let's go? Like, what is an old incumbent? What is an inefficient market?
Well, first of all, it's all about obsessing about the customer, right? like this is, people fall in love with their ideas and your idea doesn't matter. No one cares about your idea. People care if people want what you have and what you're building. And so what I do is, what's the least amount of money I can spend to simulate and test an idea to evaluate if it's interesting. And that's the only way to do that is through customer interviews. It's through mock-ups of like what a product could be. Don't go and build the most, another failure, just to kind of, while we're on the subject, to illustrate my point. I built a bilingual blogging platform for real estate. It took us 9 months. We launched it and no one used it. This is before lean startup. This is before, all of that was, kind of more commonplace for startups. So, this is very easily solved. If I would have just gone to the market, talked to the potential users, they would have said, listen, this is not something that is useful for me because of X reason. And I would have saved, I don't know how much money and how much time. Right. And so that was a hard lesson for me. And it was a 9 month of, call it lost, but I have the story to tell about it. And then when I see an entrepreneur doing the same thing, it's easy for me to identify that, like, oh, have you talked to your customer about this? Have you interviewed them? Have you done any kind of, quick MVP stuff that allows you to kind of understand how people would engage with this product before you go build it? So I think that that's absolutely critical. You need to validate, right? Like, and you need to do it as rapidly as possible and as low cost as possible, to be as efficient as possible.
I love it. So let me ask you about some of your leadership principles, because right before we got on the recording here and started get going, you and I were just chatting and sort of shooting the breeze about a couple things. And you made this comment that was really interesting to me and revealed a couple things about the way you think. And I'd like to dig into it a little more. And we were talking about security, and this question isn't actually exactly about security. It's about leadership. But we were talking about, how do you build secure software systems, which is something that I'm very, very passionate about. And your answer to that was really interesting to me, because you said, well, I have this super badass CTO. I totally trust him. He gets the job done. And what I heard from that was this idea of, and I'm way putting words in your mouth. So let's get your actual opinion of what you think about this. But it sounded to me like what you're saying was, you know, hire capable people and then empower them to do the job. Can you tell me a little bit more about your like leadership philosophies and how to build a team?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, this is something that early stage entrepreneurs often, you know, it's a challenging thing because when you're starting out, you know, you're managing a lot, you're juggling a lot. Maybe you don't have enough money to like hire someone really credible. But as you have proven your market, and let's assume that you validate your business, you've got initial traction, and then you're building that team, right? So you're kind of in that second stage of operations. You know, you found your product market fit, and you're now kind of ramping things up. You know, I think there's a couple philosophies that I have for early stage kind of entrepreneurship, and just I guess in leadership in general. Yeah, you definitely want to hire people that, you know, you don't want to be micromanaging and hiring people and telling them what to do. That's the fastest way to lose interest from extremely capable people, right? If I think back to the team that I built, you know, I was always a little like insecure about my kind of credentials. You know, I went to San Diego State. It's a great school. Everyone I came across in the venture world went to Stanford or Harvard or Wharton. I overcompensated and I hired, I think, 3 MBAs from Harvard, you know, in my early management team. And they were nails. They were amazing. But I remember in the early days having a conversation with, you know, with some of them where I had a very strong idea about what to do. One of them had already done this in another company. And we had a very candid conversation. He's like, Brian, you gotta put full trust in me. I'm gonna make this happen. From that point on, it was like long leash, like results matter. And so, you know, it's trust and verify, right? Because you don't want to give the keys to the city on day one. And I have a kind of a personal philosophy that I remember from one of my mentors, Greg Waldorf, who was a former CEO of eHarmony and, you know, a long time kind of entrepreneur and investor in the Silicon Valley. And, you know, he talked to me about, you know, we made a lot of executive hires over the years. And he said, don't get too excited about the person until they've been there for 6 months, right? Like, you know, so that was his philosophy. And he said, over 6 months, you'll know if the person is, and it's hard to make really good hires. Like, you know, a big part of your hires aren't going to work. You know, it's going to happen. But I think the key thing is you got to give them enough space. Trust and verify though, right? You know, accountability is critical. But if you don't trust them and give them the leeway to be able to execute and operate, you're gonna lose great people because great people want to have that autonomy. So I think that's fundamental. And then on the tech side, like, yeah, I mean, I'm not a technical founder, right? And I'm not a technical, you know, exec. And so, you know, you have to put almost blind trust in your partners, because, you know, there's the kind of the Stephen Covey, you know, the Speed of Trust book, which I love, you know, things just go way faster, right? And when you can, you know, you can find someone super capable, give them all that trust, it's amazing how responsive they can be when they're also given that autonomy and given that trust, because that's super motivating too, right? And the opposite is true when you don't have that, it's extremely demotivating. So I do subscribe to that. I have a couple of personal rules. Like I said, the 6 month thing is like, that's kind of the trial period. And you can really start evaluating someone after 6 months, because it's easy to be in the honeymoon stage when you hire someone, because it's like, oh, this person is going to solve all my problems. But the reality is that no one solves all of your problems. But you know, they can definitely share the burden of what you have as a founder and as an executive.
It's so interesting hearing you talk about trust and autonomy and this idea of long leash and results matter. I'm 100% on board with you. One of the things that I've found that's really striking and also a silver lining of what's been happening during this pandemic is that in the early days of it, when everyone shifted to work from home for those first, you know, few months, I started hearing all these conversations of companies being like, can you believe this? This is great. We can trust our people to work from home and get their job done. And I'm like, you didn't trust them already? Why were you employing them? I mean, we've had a work from home policy or a work from anywhere policy forever. What's your view on that? And do you think that companies are starting to adopt this mindset, or are you still sure in a sort of the small minority of.
I have a couple anecdotes that I'll share just to kind of illustrate like rookie mistakes. You know, I think that, you know, this is just kind of to give some color to the conversation. I remember when like Facebook was taking off and I was just like, everybody is on Facebook at, you know, at the office. And I'm just like this, like, do we ban Facebook? You know, like, and that was like, you know, that was like a suggestion from someone on my team. And obviously that's obviously not the way to do it. Right. Like, because that's just like telling everyone, like, we don't think that you can police yourself and you're not capable of figuring this out for yourself. And so we clearly didn't do that, but like, you know, and so I think to your point, you know, the best companies have, you know, I like to think about, you know, we mentioned the word trust. There's a framework that I really like around the DISC profile. I don't know if you know DISC. DISC profile is a framework for highly effective teams. And there's a pyramid. So if you think of a pyramid, at the base of the pyramid, you have trust. If you don't have trust in your team, there's no way you can have conflict, which is the second layer of the pyramid. In order for you to have, you know, good progress, you need to have conflict. You need to be able to confront someone and say, look, I have a different perspective than you. I want to show you my, you know, how I see things. And then you have a debate about it and you get to the best outcome. The next layer of the pyramid is commitment. If you don't have conflict, you know, and you can't, you know, be debating the things, you won't commit to each other, right? And so when you can, you know, agree to commit to it, to the next thing, and you've got that trust that enables you to have the conflict, then you have the commitment and you follow up afterwards. From there, you're going to have accountability, right? Like, okay, we committed to this. Now we've got accountability. And if you're working from home or you're working from Thailand, like, you've got accountability and it's like, you either deliver or you don't. And at the top of the pyramid, which is at the end of the day, what we're all striving for, it's results, right? And so that's a framework that we use with our team. And, you know, we worked on developing all the layers of those five things. We had an executive coach. Her name was Lynn Waldera. She's tremendous. She advises some of the kind of the top tech companies in the Bay Area. And, you know, that was something that we had to work with our team. So to answer your question in a long-winded fashion, absolutely, if you don't have those things, regardless if they're in the office or they're not in the office, it's not going to work very well. My personal philosophy on the, you know, I'm building a company right now and I haven't even met half of the people in the company. So, you have to trust that they're going to get stuff done because, and I think actually to counter kind of what people might think, I think you can actually, you know, track results as well, or even better, like in this environment, because it forces you to develop the tools to be able to kind of measure and track and communicate. And I think with this kind of no code movement that we're seeing, you know, with like, you know, things like Notion, Slack, all these other kind of software tools, those things can help in terms of, you know, remote work and communication. And so, you know, it does present some security challenges, which is probably why your business makes sense. But I think from a management standpoint, it can be done. It's hard. It requires maybe a different strategy and skill set. But, you know, I've got a friend, Alex Torrenegra, who's a shark on Shark Tank in Colombia, you know, big investor in Latin America and a longtime friend. He's been building remote companies for 15 years. And he, you know, he's been building it. He had his teams on MSN chat, right? And so his philosophy is, you can hire the best people in the world if you're remote. So I wasn't on the remote train. However, when I was starting a new company before the pandemic, I had some ideas. I wanted to do it remote because I wanted to do it in Latin America and I didn't want to move there. So I was already on the remote train kind of before this pandemic. But through the pandemic, I've learned that it's an interesting opportunity. And I think that a lot of businesses, not all of them, but many will adapt to it.
So this is a really good segue as we are coming to the close of our time here. Let's finish by talking about results. So obviously any leader, any entrepreneur, any executive, any developer, any security, like everyone is always focused on results. What's your thinking or advice on what to do when we see either an individual or a team or a department underperforming against results? How do you go about thinking about measuring whether it's the goal itself is wrong versus the execution of the goal versus the individual's capability? How do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, we're instituting, and in my last company, we had OKRs, which is the objectives and key results, which was, you know, a framework developed by Intel, which was adopted by Google. And it's a pretty common framework for kind of managing your roadmap and your priorities. You know, I think that part of the OKRs are that you have stretch goals too. And so part of it is like, you actually don't hit your goals almost, because if you don't stretch, you know, your goal, then you don't want to sandbag and like, you know, forecast something. And then it's like, oh, so you can crush. And so by default, Google like doesn't actually, it's very rare that you hit your target, perfectly. And so that's a question, you know, it's a question mark in terms of how that works. And if it works for every company, part of it is the DNA of the business. You know, in terms of how to make sure you hit results, like I think that, you know, there's an interesting kind of combo of, you know, you've got to give the long leash, but you've got to measure everything, right? So like we, you know, the way we operate in our company is we have daily meetings. They're 15 minutes. We review our Notion board, which has the week's, you know, the week kind of objectives. So we break things into very micro elements so that, you know, there's really no hiding, right? Like either you did or you didn't. And it's the opportunity to say, I need some help on this. And it's a very efficient meeting. It's very transparent. And it's an opportunity where there's just collective accountability. And so I think that you need to over communicate and you need to have this stuff laid out very openly for everybody. So everyone kind of knows what everyone's working on. And that obviously works in a small team. It becomes increasingly complex as you have a large organization, right? So when you're running a 500 person team, it's obviously different than when you have an 8-person team. I do think a lot of the same principles apply. They're just more on a team basis, rather than like a company-wide basis. So, you know, I think that, you know, it's a combination of like giving people the freedom to like choose what, you know, what they're working on and how they're going to execute on what they're going to do, and less about like the how and more about the what and like where you want to get. And then it's just like, you know, it's gotta be in front of everybody and it's gotta be super open, and you almost feel obligated to make sure that you're holding your end of the bargain up. And so that's where the accountability comes in, you know, on that framework. But we do dailies. We have metrics that report, you know, you've got to have all of the data that backs up, everything that you've done. And, you know, the more transparency, the better for everybody.
I love it. One last question for you before we wrap up. So let's pull out your crystal ball and, you know, what are you excited about? What's the big change or transformation that you think is going to happen in, you know, pick your market, pick whatever your view is over the say next 12 months? What's the big thing that's coming around the corner?
Well, I can share only what's kind of on my, you know, on my plate and how I'm thinking about things. You know, I spent the last 10 years of my last company, building businesses in Latin America. And, you know, I think that when I look at kind of the global economy, I look at a region of 700 million people, that receives, you know, half of the investment of India, yet the economy of the region is twice as large. So my personal thing that I'm excited about is, you know, and that's one thing that I wrote a book recently called Viva the Entrepreneur. And my goal is to basically elevate the next generation of iconic companies being built in Latin America. And so that's my priority personally for the next 12 months. If I look at kind of how things are evolving, you know, I avoid crystal balls, because I think that, you know, the weatherman can't even tell you yesterday's weather sometimes. So, right. You know, I'm in California where there's, you know, fires and, you know, floods pouring rain last night. So like, I try not to predict things that I can't. I like to predict things that I can control and influence. And what I will definitely double down on over the next 12 months is, you know, I'm building out a community of entrepreneurs. I'd like to build out become the place where the next founder is building, the next generation of tech companies start their journey, and aggregate knowledge, advice, and capital, to make sure that they can do that effectively and tackle all of the friction points that exist in that region. So my next 12 months will be highly dedicated to that as I launch Latitude and my book in conjunction with that. So those are what's on my docket for the next 12 months. I'm not a very good futurist. I like to make the future instead of predict it. And so that's kind of what I'm focused on.
I love it. Well, from one author to another, I really wish you all the best success. And thank you so much for sharing all this wisdom today. Brian, you're great.
Thank you, man. Really enjoyed the chat and look forward to continuing the conversation.
Yeah, same here. And for everybody listening, if you want to learn more about this episode or more or appear on the show yourself, just go to tedharrington.com/podcast. And we'll catch you next time.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Tech Done Different podcast with Ted Harrington. If you learned something new and this conversation made you think, then share ITSPmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.